Welcome to this special edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. It's now been 54 years since the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. It's astonishing to me that fewer than one-third of all Americans living today were alive on that fateful day, Friday, November 22, 1963. But for those of us who were alive, it's become an awful and indelible moment that's haunted us for decades. I was in a classroom at Niles East High School in Skokie, Illinois, when someone rushed in to say that the president had been shot. I remember laughing with a friend because we thought it had to be a joke. We soon learned it was a grim reality.
And now, for the next 30 minutes, as the world turns.
For those who were at home that day and who were watching the popular CBS soap opera As the World Turns, the news came in a series of bulletins delivered by Walter Cronkite.
Deal of thought, Grandpa.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
And then it was back to the soap for just a few moments.
This picture has just been transmitted by wire. It is a picture taken just a moment or two before the incident. If you can zoom in.
Finally, after 2 p.m. Eastern time, Cronkite was back with his now famous terrible official update.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Some 38 minutes ago.
The events of that day and the long weekend that had Americans glued to their televisions watching the lying in state, the funeral, and much more are all well known. So today, as we mark the anniversary of his death, we're going to focus on the young John Kennedy, the vibrant World War II Navy veteran who was nudged into a political career by his famous Democratic power broker father, Joseph Kennedy, but who eventually embraced the role with enthusiasm and dedication to his cause to become eventually the President of the United States. To do that, we're going to talk to Curtis Wilkie. He's the co-author of The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's 5-Year Campaign. It's an in-depth look at how Kennedy became president. Curtis Wilkie was a national and foreign correspondent for the Boston Globe. He and the book's co-author, Thomas Oliphant, were part of the Globe's celebrated team covering presidential races. Curtis covered 8 presidential campaigns starting in 1972. He finally retired from the newspaper business in 2004 and returned to his home state of Mississippi, where he teaches journalism at the University of Mississippi. We're going to pick up the story at the 1956 Democratic Convention. JFK is a young, relatively unknown U.S. senator from Massachusetts, but his father, Joe, has a plan to elevate him to higher office. Joe Kennedy tries to strike a deal with Lyndon Johnson. He says he'll back a Johnson bid to become the presidential nominee if LBJ promises to put his son on the ticket as vice president. The idea goes nowhere because it seems certain that the Democrats are going to nominate Adlai Stevenson to be their candidate for president. But Kennedy has now been bitten by the bug. He decides to make a bid to become Stevenson's running mate.
He really began working toward that end in early 1956. He did a number of things. They knew that Catholicism would be an issue, and they cobbled together something that eventually became known as the Bailey Report that argued that Catholicism would not necessarily be a hindrance. And this was done in the spring of 56. Also, something that I had never heard about in all the years I worked for the Boston Globe, and it turned out to be a very delicious chapter for us. Kennedy was basically advised by the Irish Mafia to take control of the state Democratic Committee, and they had an absolutely rowdy, raucous, damn near brawl, and Kennedy ousted the state chairman, a guy named Onions Burke, and seized control of the state party apparatus. It up until then had been controlled by John McCormick.
John W. McCormick, right?
Yeah, and McCormick and the Kennedys never got along anyway. So, again, this was a daring move on the part of Kennedy to take on this established force in both Congress and in the state Democratic Party and beat him out. And so all these things are into play well before he went out to Chicago. And he had inside information from friends with Stevenson that it was conceivable that Stevenson would throw the choice of his running mate to the convention.
It has been traditional that a presidential candidate selects his running mate and then gets the convention to approve that selection. But Adlai Stevenson was a man who, among his failings, was an indecisiveness that really at times paralyzed him. And he just didn't know how to pick among the candidates who were out there for him, right?
Yeah, this was also, in my lifetime, it's the only time this has happened, that the candidate didn't want to pick his own running mate. And you're right, it was a mark of Stevenson's indecisiveness. He was dogged by it throughout his political career.
So he had some choices. Hubert Humphrey, Al Gore Sr. was in the mix. Who else? Estes Kefauver. So there was a menu of people who could be potentially vice presidential running mate.
And people who were very prominent in the party at that time, too.
And Kennedy, again, was a relatively unknown figure on the national stage. He really hadn't established himself clearly, but he went after the nomination with a hunger and a drive that would mark his entire political career, right?
That's right. And he was sort of set up for some prominence at that convention by allies within the party. And he gave a first night performance where he narrated a documentary that was shown. And then he later nominated Stevenson from the floor. So he was getting probably as much television time before he actually became a candidate than anyone. And then on the third or fourth night of the convention, Stevenson announces he's going to throw it to the convention, and Jack Kennedy was ready. He was more prepared for it than any of the others.
I want to take a moment. This is kind of an interesting footnote. I believe that I make sure that I got this right, please, Curtis. Kennedy's nominating speech on behalf of Adlai Stevenson was set for 11 in the morning.
Yeah, that's a great story because they gave him a speech to deliver, that is, the Stevenson people. Ted Sorensen, who was Kennedy's close aide and speechwriter and a very gifted wordsmith, they looked at it and they were appalled. They said, this thing's terrible. And they were unwilling to deliver what the Stevenson people had presented them with. And overnight, Sorensen put together a fresh speech. And they typed it up and they had it ready for the teleprompter. And Kennedy is going down in a taxi and he suddenly realized that, you know, a page was missing that they were going to give to the teleprompter. And they had picked up along the way the guy who turned out to be one of my great editors and a father figure for me, a guy named Tom Winship, who later became editor of the Boston Globe, but at the time was there as a reporter. And so Winship took the missing stuff and went into the press room and typed it up for Kennedy so that they were able to deliver it to the teleprompter with minutes to spare before he went on to speak.
Yeah, that is a great story. What's also fascinating is when you think about the way conventions are staged today, the notion that there would be a major nominating speech for a presidential candidate at 11 o'clock in the morning instead of at prime time tells you a lot about how conventions have changed in the decades since then.
Well, you know, they've been chaotic also. I remember the 1972 Democrat convention where George McGovern wound up giving his acceptance speech about 3 in the morning.
Yes.
It doesn't always work smoothly, but you're right. You know, the conventions today are so scripted. They're not very spontaneous, and quite frankly, they're boring. I can't imagine watching 4 hours of a convention today.
As we go along, there's some interesting Georgia connections to your story. One of the people who Jack Kennedy called upon for help in dealing with maybe winning the vice presidential nomination as he started courting delegates from the states was a guy from right here in Atlanta, Robert Troutman, who was the founding partner, one of the founding partners of Troutman Sanders, one of the best-known law firms in Georgia.
Right. He was one of Kennedy's early supporters in Georgia and worked closely with him. He also called upon his buddy George Smathers, senator from Florida, you know, try to rally some Southern support. And this is where that 56th convention got very interesting. It was when the battle wound up between Kennedy and Estes Kefauver from Tennessee.
Two things. First, meeting with Troutman, meeting with other Southern political leaders, Democratic political leaders, as he's trying to get the vice presidential nomination, of course, is also setting the stage for people in the South he is going to turn to when he decides very quickly after losing the vice presidential nomination, he's going to run for president. That's really where his efforts to win Southern support led after the 56th convention.
Yeah, no question. I think he left Chicago thinking he had a lot of support that he had developed in states, which would have been surprising. And actually, he got that support during the fight for the vice presidential nomination because, you know, the South was much different politically then. It was controlled by Democrats, and they were very conservative Democrats. And they could not stand Estes Kefauver from Tennessee. Even in Kefauver's own Tennessee delegation, the people didn't like him. And when it developed that it was a fight between Kennedy and Kefauver, virtually all the Southern delegations voted for Kennedy. They were attracted by this bright young guy who was very telegenic and was, they thought, appealing. He was not a far-out liberal, and they felt he was acceptable. So he left Chicago with the notion that he had a chance to make real breakthroughs in the South in the years leading up to the next election in 1960. And he traveled a great deal and courted these Southern Democrats assiduously.
Yeah, before we get to the presidential race, I really would like you to help us understand a really fascinating story you tell in the book. One of the people who did not much like JFK in those days was Eleanor Roosevelt. That was a difficult situation for Kennedy because she was an iconic figure in the Democratic Party. But you write about a meeting between Kennedy and Eleanor Roosevelt in which she makes very clear her distaste for him.
Yeah, she brushes him off. That again is at the convention. He goes to her hotel room where she's in a suite with members of her family. And rather than having a private session, he's there talking over the chatter of her grandchildren and friends, and the phone's ringing, and she just basically kisses him off. She asks him essentially one question, said, "Why did you not censure Joe McCarthy, the the witch hunting senator from Wisconsin, who Kennedy had been one of the few people in the Democratic side who had not voted?" And Kennedy claimed that he had been sidelined by his illness and didn't fully understand the vote, that he could have paired himself with someone even though he was absent to be on record, but he was never on record, and she resented that a lot. But on top of that, she couldn't stand Joe Kennedy because Joe Kennedy had turned out to be an albatross for her husband.
Right, because he had been
the late President Roosevelt.
Yeah,
because he had not exactly distinguished himself as ambassador to the court of St. James, to England in the period leading up to World War II.
he worked against the President Roosevelt's planning to get involved in the war. He was an accommodator. Many people fell to the Nazi regime. He became a great embarrassment to President Roosevelt.
Yeah, you know, some people said he was, you know, it's a little extreme. He wasn't a Nazi sympathizer, but he certainly was saying, you know, basically, England's doomed. They're not going to win. And he didn't want the U.S. to get involved in the fight against Hitler.
We're going to take a break right now, but when we come back, more with Curtis Wilkie, co-author of The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's 5-Year Campaign. If you're just joining us, this is a special edition of Political Rewind. As the country marks the 54th anniversary of JFK's assassination, we're looking at the young John Kennedy and his quest for the White House. We're talking with Curtis Wilkie. He's the co-author with Thomas Oliphant of The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's 5-Year Campaign. It's an in-depth look at how John Kennedy became President of the United States. As we pick up our conversation, JFK has just lost his bid to be Adlai Stevenson's vice presidential running mate at the 1956 Democratic Convention. But Kennedy concedes with grace as he looks to his political future.
Recognizing that this convention has selected a man who has campaigned in all parts of the country, who has worked untiringly for the party, who will serve as an admirable running mate to Governor Stevenson, I hope that this convention will make Estes Kefauver's nomination unanimous. Thank you.
So Jack Kennedy, in many ways, doesn't get the VP nod, but he's had, in many ways, a very successful convention because of his, as you pointed out, prominent roles in front of the television cameras. And he graciously gives that speech about Kefauver. But then it begins. One of the things you tell us about Jack Kennedy is that the hallmark of his campaigning all the way back to his days in Congress was he always began before anyone else thought about the race. He began early.
Yeah, start early was his mantra.
Which means that in 1956, he was already beginning to think about the 1960 presidential election and trying to win the Democratic nomination.
No question. And because he had become a hot ticket because of the convention, the Stevenson people wanted very much for him to go around the country speaking on behalf of the Democratic ticket. And Kennedy basically determined where he would go, and he disregarded their suggestions that, you know, we'd like for you to go to, let's say, Iowa. He would go where he wanted to go. And meanwhile, he had his brother, Robert Kennedy, on the campaign traveling with Adlai Stevenson, and all the while, Bob Kennedy is taking notes about what's going on, what are they doing, and basically all the mistakes that the Stevenson campaign made. An interesting sidelight is Robert Kennedy was so appalled by the ineffectiveness of Adlai Stevenson that he later confided privately he voted for Eisenhower.
So Kennedy's out there, and again, we have an Atlanta connection as he starts to look at 1960. He called up Leonard Reinch in Atlanta. Who was Leonard Reinch?
He was a guy who became a media guru for Kennedy. He was a guy very well connected. He knew television, which was still in its infancy back then. If I recall, Billy also had Cox family connections.
He ran Cox Communications.
Right, and that goes back to, you know, the Cox who ran for president decades earlier. So there were this was a guy very grounded in politics and media, and this was a time when this was something new. Nobody was going out and calling in for help of someone like Reinch, who would become, I guess, one of the first media gurus ever.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to me, Curtis, because You point out that Kennedy really got television before any other major candidate did. So television was slowly becoming a more dominant force, and Kennedy turned to Leonard Reinsch because he got that. But even without Leonard Reinsch, Kennedy was attracting media attention in other ways. Let's listen, for instance, to his appearance on Person to Person. Right after he got married, he goes on Person to Person. Edward R. Murrow is the host of this program, the great American journalist who CBS has pushed into this uncomfortable position of interviewing celebrities. But it was a tremendously popular show. Let's listen to Jack and Jackie Kennedy on Person to Person.
The Kennedys were married last month. They're still looking for a place to live in Washington. On weekdays, they stay up in Boston. But so much for the history. Let's go and meet the newlyweds. Are you there, Senator?
Yes, right here, Mr. Morrow.
Good evening, sir.
Thank you.
Good evening, Mrs. Kennedy.
Good evening.
Well, have you opened all your wedding gifts?
Well, I've opened quite a few of them, and I've sent them all to Washington. We just have a couple back here.
Uh-huh. Senator, I wonder if you would show us around your apartment a bit?
Certainly will. Fine,
Morrow. Well, it was a pretty awkward interview. We're going to post a link to that interview on the Two-Way Street website and Facebook page. But he got it. He understood what a humanizing element a television could bring to him.
Yeah, it was pretty corny, but you know, certainly Jackie Kennedy was a major asset to him in terms of getting on the cover of, you know, Life and Look and things like that. Huge spread in Life magazine when they were married. It was just, they exuded glamour.
Let's move forward. In 1960, like the years previous to that, the whole notion of how you won a nomination was entirely different than the way we see winning a nomination today. In earlier eras, deciding to compete in primaries was not a given. You chose a few primaries here and there, but most people believed that a nominee was going to be chosen at the convention itself. And you weighed the factors of it, of a primary fight as opposed to the convention fight, right?
Right. And back then, there weren't that many primaries anyway.
One primary that it had not achieved the prominence it does have today completely, but New Hampshire still mattered in many ways. And Kennedy began courting Democratic leaders in New Hampshire. Would you mind if I read to you just a brief passage from your book?
Sure.
I love the way you describe New Hampshire, because it's true today as it was then.
Well, I think I remember you and I trudging around in New Hampshire.
We did a lot of that. Aren't you glad we're not doing that anymore, by the way? Because when we did it, you really had access to people. You could talk to the candidates. You could get up close to them. I don't think it'd be any fun at all.
Yeah, it's gone. It's gone. You're right.
So here's your quote. Like a Kentucky Derby once sprinkled with unworthy colts whose rich owners were willing to pay the entrance fee, the New Hampshire primary attracted egomaniacs who signed up as candidates for the splendor of seeing their names briefly in lights. Okay, so Kennedy does set out to get involved in some of the primaries. Can we talk about the obstacles that he knew he was going to have to overcome going into the election? Age, religion, and his voting record. And religion, his being a Catholic, was probably the obstacle that he, well, you tell me, is that the one that worried them the most?
Yeah, Bill, in working on this book, I had forgotten what an enormous issue Catholicism was at that time. And of course, after Kennedy's election, it disappeared. It's never been an issue since. But it was an enormous issue, and he knew it was a double-edged sword, that there were a lot of people who didn't want to vote for a Catholic, but at the same time, tens of thousands of Catholics, particularly in some of the big northern industrial states, who were quite ready to vote for a Catholic candidate, would be happy to embrace him. So it cut both ways, and unlike Al Smith, who was, of course, the Catholic who was on the Democratic ticket in 1928, Smith had kind of run from it. Kennedy confronted it. Kennedy talked openly about his Catholicism, challenged people. His brother, of course, had died in World War II, and he says, you know, my brother gave his life for this country. Does it mean that because we're Catholic that we're not eligible to be president? So he had some very good arguments to counter what people thought would have been a major handicap.
But there was this fear among much of the Protestant—or not much, I take that back. There was a fear among some in the Protestant community.
Especially in a place like Wisconsin, where you had a concentration of Lutheran voters, and you know, all you got to do is think who Martin Luther was, and you know they're naturally not going to be ready to accept a Catholic. And so that was a problem Kennedy had in that first pivotal primary in Wisconsin, was trying to deal with a heavy Lutheran vote.
Wisconsin was a great example of why a fundamental rule in politics has to be keeping expectations low. What happened to Kennedy in Wisconsin in that regard?
Yeah, they made a mistake and basically began highballing it and talking about how they were going to carry virtually all of the congressional districts. And then when it turns out that, I can't remember, 10 or 11 CDs, and instead of carrying 10 of them, I think he escaped with
he won six.
Six of the 10.
Yeah.
And so therefore it diminished the outcome, even though he won and wound up with more votes and more delegates. It didn't look that overwhelming because they had touted privately to reporters, oh, we're going to carry this thing big time. And they didn't.
Yeah. And so he goes on a little bit wounded. And next big target is West Virginia. And West Virginia is important. Kennedy said there are people who are advising Kennedy not to go to West Virginia.
Including his father.
Joe
father
Kennedy.
Says, don't you dare go there.
But he went for a very specific reason, didn't he?
To prove that a Catholic could win in a state that was predominantly Protestant.
Right. Confronting that issue head on.
That was by far the most interesting of all the primaries. It's a poor state back then, depending on the mining industry. And he actually, for the first time, saw hunger. He saw poor, poor people. And there was some affinity for that with Jack Kennedy. He went into the mines, and he was dealing with something that he'd really never seen before. You had that going on, and then it was a pretty corrupt state, or it was then. You know, you could buy votes. You would pay off the sheriffs, and the sheriffs basically ran each of the counties. And money was pouring into that state, not only from Joe Kennedy, and it literally were bringing cash in suitcases to be distributed. But Lyndon Johnson, meanwhile, was pouring cash from Texas in support of Hubert Humphrey to try to stop this Kennedy juggernaut.
So Hubert Humphrey is in that West Virginia primary. He is already an active candidate against Kennedy for president. Meanwhile, LBJ is sitting it out. He's on the sidelines in Texas. He is not going to enter, if he enters at all, until the convention itself. So go ahead.
Yeah, he's thinking, you know, that all of his power broker friends will be able to deliver the nomination to him in the end without having to fool with the primaries.
So he went, okay, but so Kennedy went, he beats Humphrey 61%, I think, to like 38-39%.
And that was the end of Humphrey.
Humphrey drops out. Kennedy moves on after West Virginia. Religion still haunts him. And he's getting pounded by some of the great leaders of the evangelical community, the Protestant community. Norman Vincent Peale argues that if Kennedy's elected, he will be beholden to the Pope before he is in service to the United States of America. And there are other leaders of note who opposed him because of that.
Well, most prominent, Billy Graham. Billy Graham had a conclave, a private conclave in Switzerland in the summer of 1960 with some of these evangelical leaders, including Norman Vincent Peale and others. What can we do to thwart the Kennedy campaign? There's correspondence back and forth between Billy Graham and Richard Nixon and the Nixon campaign. There was literally a conspiracy between these evangelical ministers and the Nixon campaign to try to torpedo the Kennedy campaign on the issue of Catholicism.
Let's talk just briefly about one of the ways in which Kennedy addressed religion. He goes to Houston in September of 1960. He's invited to speak by a group of Protestants who really are prepared to confront him, am I right, on the issue of religion. And he gives one of the most important speeches in terms of religion of the campaign.
The Kennedy campaign anticipated how it would come out, and they arranged for it to be televised live in the state of Texas. And they took the clips from that and used it in their commercials in so many of the, particularly in the southern states.
Let's listen to just a little bit of the speech that Kennedy gave on that day in September in 1960.
I believe in an America that is officially neither Catholic, Protestant, nor Jewish, where no public official either requests or accepts instructions on public policy from the Pope, the National Council of Churches, or any other ecclesiastical source. For while this year it may be a Catholic against whom the finger of suspicion is pointed, today I may be the victim, but tomorrow it may be you.
What do you think when you hear that little excerpt?
It's very impressive.
We're going to take another break right now. When we come back, I'll have more with Curtis Wilkie. Welcome back to this special edition of Political Rewind. I'm talking with Curtis Wilkie. He's the co-author of The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's Five-Year Campaign. It's an in-depth look at how Kennedy became president. As we pick up the conversation, Curtis and I are talking about the careful balancing act Kennedy had to maintain as he courted white anti-integration Southern governors and at the same time recognized he had to appeal to African-American voters in the North. And as you'll hear, Georgia played a big role in how JFK's strategy unfolded.
That became very crucial as it went along. But, we described it as a tightrope that Kennedy walked through the fall when he was courting the Southerners. And there had been the old Democratic Solid South, that the South voted monolithically for Democrats. And it was felt particularly by Kennedy's aides that if he was showing too much sympathy for this civil rights movement that was just really beginning, that he would antagonize these Southerners and the people that he had been courting and jeopardize his ability to carry the electoral votes of these Southern states. So he was hesitant about getting too close and embracing too fully the civil rights movement at the beginning. At the same time, he recognized that there were literally thousands of black voters in places like New York and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan, Illinois, states like that, which could make the difference in these states. So it was something of a dilemma that he faced.
I want to talk about the Georgia, the Atlanta story in a minute. But before we do, we skipped over, and it in itself is a great story. He was fortunate to have LBJ as his running mate. It was a complicated dance that brought LBJ to the ticket. But at least if he was starting to embrace, even in a hesitant and limited way, civil rights leaders, he had LBJ in the South reminding his Southern white counterparts that that the ticket had something for them, too. Is that a fair way of saying it?
Yeah, that was essentially why I, in the end, chose LBJ. He had all along recognized that LBJ would be a very valuable running mate, but he didn't necessarily get along that well with LBJ. And his brother, who was running his campaign, Bobby Kennedy, he despised LBJ, and LBJ despised Bobby Kennedy. So there's really bad blood there. And Kennedy did not want to offer a place on the ticket because he didn't think LBJ would accept it. So he didn't offer it. He was prepared to pick Senator Stuart Symington from Missouri as his running mate right up until the last hours after he had gotten the nomination in hand that he suddenly made this decision, well, I'm going to approach LBJ and see if he's interested, and damned if he wasn't.
All right, so we're in the general election. We've got LBJ on the ticket with JFK, and of course, we've got a Republican opponent in Richard Nixon. Poor Richard Nixon is handicapped early on when a reporter asks President Eisenhower what he can say about the accomplishments that Richard Nixon made as vice president. And what does President Eisenhower famously say?
He said, if you give me a week, I might think of something. And nobody ever knew whether he was just being flippant, whether he was serious, or whether he wanted to stick it to Nixon, who he'd never been particularly close to anyway. But it certainly was not helpful to Nixon.
Yeah. It was a long time later, Eisenhower finally stood before the cameras and the microphones and said this.
Heading our ticket is Richard Nixon, the possessor of a vast richness of experience in domestic affairs, foreign relations, and person-to-person diplomacy. In important functions and executive work, he has served the nation well.
All right, so here we go. Finally, the President of the United States encourages voters to go to the polls for Richard Nixon. As the campaign is unfolding, the polls are tight virtually throughout the general election campaign, as I recall, and as I think you say in the book.
Yeah. In fact, we found Lou Harris polls, who was working for Kennedy, that showed, even though it's kind of a myth that Kennedy won the debates because he looked better on TV and Nixon looked like he'd been sleeping under a bridge, but that the polls never really varied after the debates. And you're right, it was very, very close.
So the Kennedy campaign realizes that they do have to find a way to court what they would have called then the Negro vote. Kennedy tries to meet with Martin Luther King Jr. after, a dance in which they can't seem to get together. But the first meeting, MLK comes away, I think you quote him as saying, Kennedy did not have the grasp and the comprehension of the depth of the problem. I could see he did not have the emotional involvement. He didn't know too many Negroes personally. So Kennedy, after that meeting, had to work hard to try to win the black vote.
Yeah, they had a second meeting, and Martin King was more impressed with him after that, but he was still unwilling to endorse him. And the Kennedy campaign was actively seeking an endorsement. And Dr. King said, I can't do that. I'm not in the business of making political endorsements.
So that brings us to what I think is one of the most remarkable series of events in that entire race. And it's very much a part of Georgia history, of Atlanta history. On one hand, you have the governor of Georgia, Governor Vandeveer, even Griffin Bell, who of course became Jimmy Carter's attorney general, who are really kind of standing strong as white Southern Democrats who want to be able to work with Kennedy. And on the other side of it, you have civil rights figures, people like MLK, who need Kennedy to stand up for them.
Yeah, and of course it all comes to a head 3 weeks before the election when Dr. King and a number of students from some of the HBCUs in Atlanta were arrested at Rich's department store.
They went to the Magnolia Room in Rich's downtown to demand service at lunch, and 35 students and Dr. King are arrested. You point out something really interesting. This was the first time that Dr. King went to jail.
it was, and he was unwilling to be bailed out. The students wanted to stay in jail. It's a symbolic gesture, and he felt that he should do the same thing, and so they stayed in jail over the weekend. And people were concerned about it. There was picketing by blacks in Atlanta as a result. And Mayor Hartsfield was anxious to settle this, and so was Governor Vandiver. And they thought that they had it arranged that Dr. King would be freed after a weekend in jail. And yet forces intervened, and they hauled him back to DeKalb County, where he faced this ridiculous old traffic ticket. He and his wife had been driving Lillian Smith to get a treatment for cancer, and he had been arrested because he was driving with an Alabama driver's license. And so he had been basically under a sort of probation. And the judge in DeKalb County said, you know, you have broken disagreement to be law-abiding by being arrested at Rich's, and I'm sentencing you to 4 months of hard labor. And this is then where it really gets tough, and I think it is ultimately is the incident that swings the election for Jack Kennedy.
First of all, Dr. King is in the DeKalb jail. The judge, as you point out, gives out this sentence, and then in shackles, Dr. King is sent to Reidsville, the state prison, notorious for its mistreatment, especially of African-American prisoners.
Right. And Dr. King's wife, Coretta, understandably feared for his life, and so did his followers. And so they are seeking help from almost any place they can get it. And one of them would be either Richard Nixon or John Kennedy, both involved in this horse race for the presidency. And Mrs. King contacts Harris Wofford, who was a young white guy working for Kennedy in the civil rights office, but had a lot of experience working with the civil rights leaders and was friendly with the King family. And she tells him, she weeps and she is troubled. And so Harris Wofford thinks that Kennedy should intervene. He is almost alone in the Kennedy campaign in feeling that way. The rest of the people, all the Irish mafia, they're all saying, don't you dare get involved here. You know, you'll jeopardize what standing you have with the Southern Democrats if you try to help Martin King. And Wofford's phone calls, almost desperate phone calls to Jack Kennedy, they're not passed on to the candidate. So finally, Harris Wofford thinks I should call Sarge Shriver, who was Kennedy's brother-in-law and was in Chicago and very active in civil rights. And he did, and he was able to get through to Sarge Shriver. Kennedy's in a hotel room at O'Hare Airport in Chicago, and Shriver waits until Pierre Salinger and Ted Sorensen and Kenny O'Donnell, all three top assistants to Kennedy who would oppose this, until they left the room, and he's finally alone with Jack Kennedy, and he lays out the case for making a call. And Kennedy says, well, sure, you know, give me her number and I'll dial her up and I'll call her. And he did. The conversation only lasted 2 or 3 minutes, but it was comforting to Mrs. King. Dr. King's father, Daddy King, who was a very prominent figure himself, had been prepared to vote for Nixon. And he announced that he was changing. He was going to vote for Jack Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy is furious when he learns that his brother has made this call. And Kennedy, Bobby, goes off in a snit, and it feels like they have blown the election, that they've blown the possibility of carrying the Southern states because of this one phone call. At the same time, Kennedy, Bobby, again, is troubled as a lawyer over the lack of due process. And so Bob Kennedy is the one who talked to the judge, and the judge followed through and released Martin King. And meanwhile, Richard Nixon had done nothing, and the Kennedy people exploited it to a fairly well. They had literally hundreds of thousands of leaflets printed up.
Called them blue bombs.
Called the blue bomb, talking about Kennedy did this and Nixon did nothing, and they were circulated in all the African-American churches, even in the bars in Harlem. And there was suddenly this great groundswell of support for Kennedy that had been lukewarm up until that time from the black voters in the northern states. And Eisenhower, for one, said that that was what made the difference in that very, very close election.
One of the things that's so wonderful about that story, I think, Curtis, is that in so many African-American homes, you find two portraits on the wall of many African-American homes. MLK, of course. But the other one, who?
Yep.
John Kennedy.
Yep. You know, there's an interesting, just a quick personal story. I covered Bob Kennedy's trip to the Mississippi Delta in 1967, and he made an impromptu trip into a plantation shack, and there was an old couple there, and they were Mr. and Mrs. Andrew Jackson, and Bob Kennedy came into the room, and there was, this was 67, of course, a picture of his brother on the wall with, if I recall, maybe a picture of Jesus. And this nice old man looks at him in disbelief, and he says, "Are you really Mr. Robert Kennedy?" And Bob Kennedy says, "Yes, sir. And are you really Mr. Andrew Jackson?" It was a great moment.
On election day, the vote is counted throughout the night. Richard Nixon does come out at one point in the early morning hours and tell his crowd of supporters that if things continue the way they appear to be going, Kennedy will most likely win the election. But it's well into a Wednesday before the final results are clear. And Kennedy beat Nixon by a razor-thin margin. Kennedy won 34,220,000 votes. Nixon won 34,108,000 votes. So we're talking about under 250,000 or so votes separating the two of them. And Richard Nixon conceded graciously, but it was one of the closest elections we've ever seen.
It was, and it was nearly that close in the Electoral College also. Yeah.
Well, Curtis, it's been a joy to talk to you today. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Bill, it's always fun. Hope I see you sometime personally.
Curtis Wilkie's book is The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's 5-Year Campaign. It was co-written by Curtis's longtime Boston Globe colleague, Thomas Oliphant. It was less than a week after JFK's assassination that Americans sat down for Thanksgiving dinner on November 28, 1963. In Washington, President Johnson had been in office for just 6 days when on that Thanksgiving evening, he spoke to the nation from the Oval Office about the somber nature of the holiday that year.
"Tonight, on this Thanksgiving, I come before you to ask your help, to ask your strength, to ask your prayers that God may guard this republic and guide my every labor. All of us have lived through 7 days that none of us will ever forget. We are not given the divine wisdom to answer why this has been, but we are given the human duty of determining what is to be. What is to be for America, for the world, for the cause we lead, for all the hopes that live in our hearts. A great leader is dead. A great nation must move on. Yesterday is not ours to recover, but tomorrow is ours to win or to lose.
Now, 54 years later, I hope that your Thanksgiving is a joyous occasion and that you have much to be thankful for and to celebrate. Political Rewind is produced by Tom Faust. Our associate producer is Olivia Rheingold. Olivia edited today's show. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nigut. See you again after the long holiday weekend for another Political Rewind next Monday at 2:00.